Good morning, everyone. We're going to open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you for being here today, Tuesday. We have no committee bills, I don't think. Do we?
I don't have any, no.
All right, so we don't have any work session for possible introduction. We're going to go into public hearings. And at this point, it looks like we'll just work right down the agenda as we have it. So we'll start a public hearing and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 188. Eric.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 188 comes to this committee from the Office of the Attorney General. The bill creates the new crime of the unlawful dissemination of an intimate image. The bill would prohibit the non-consensual disclosure of an intimate image to a website with a specific intent to harass, humiliate, or injure another person. The first violation would be a Class A misdemeanor, with each subsequent violation constituting a Class C felony. There is no revenue impact. We do not yet have a fiscal impact. There is one amendment before the committee.
All right, thank you. So what we're going to do is we have, it looks like, six different individuals that have currently signed up. Aaron Knott, who's with the Department of Justice, needs to go first because of other commitments. Aaron, why don't you come on up? Do you have anyone else that you would like to have on that panel?
No.
Okay.
Senator Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I am the legislative director for the Attorney General and the Oregon Department of Justice here in support of Senate Bill 188. This concept addresses what is commonly called revenge porn, which is what happens when an intimate image is uploaded onto the internet without the consent of the person depicted. I became involved in this back in the short session last year when representatives and members on both sides actually approached me and said this is something they were interested in working on. A bill draft was generated, and I think the ACLU and I actually tripped over each other running to the Capitol waving our arms about how the concept was unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. And it was fairly clear that it was. So that started a six-month consultation between the Department of Justice, Legislative Council, the ACLU, OCDLA, and ODAA on how to generate a constitutional version of a bill that would be effective in combating revenge porn. Senate Bill 188 is the result of that conversation. So this is definitely a creature of our times. 10 years ago, what is now known as revenge porn existed, if at all, only in very dark corners of the internet. It was something that was traded on Usenet sites, and it didn't have a lot of profile. In recent years, it's exploded in two different venues. The first one is there are websites now that are dedicated exclusively to hosting revenge porn. They have names like myx.com, whosup.com is a famous one. And the way these websites work is someone will upload pictures, explicit pictures of another person without their consent. And frequently, this is also done with their name, their address, their occupation, their employer, where they live, their email address, which has two effects. First of all, it exposes that person to harassment by anybody who sees these pictures over the internet and wants to spout off about them. But secondly, and importantly, anytime anyone does a Google search under that person's name, an employer, a family member, a landlord, whomever, what comes up very early in the search are those intimate images. And once unleashed on the internet, it is virtually impossible for those images to be taken down. So the harm, reputationally, psychologically, is profound and potentially lifelong. But the task of figuring out how to regulate this effectively on the state level is sort of bracketed on either side. On the one side, you have the Federal Communications Decency Act, also known as Section 230. Section 230 is a federal law that essentially says that unless the content of a website either constitutes a copyright violation or limits or violates a very limited subset of criminal law, which is almost always targeted at child pornography, states have no ability to regulate it. And I thought that was an important part of the record for our purposes, because a question that I receive frequently is, well, if these websites are so big and so bad and they are doing so much damage, why don't we simply target the website? The answer is it's very clear under federal law that we can't, at least not on the state level. On the other side are the requirements of the Constitution, both federal and state. Now, and as I think we're all aware, the freedom of speech in Oregon is some of the most robust in the country. So navigating that is actually more tricky than navigating the federal version. And this is most of what we've been doing for the past 6 months, is just trying to figure out how to navigate the state constitution. So I want to give just a little bit of background about how these tests work. So it's the general principle is you cannot prohibit speech. That's fairly clear. But the when it becomes permitted is when you focus on not the speech itself, but the harm that it creates. And the way that that plays out in Senate Bill 188 is it's not enough to upload an intimate image. You need to do it with the intent to harass, humiliate, or injure another person. So intent is important there. Then the other person does, in fact, need to be harassed, humiliated, or injured, and the experience of that harm needs to be reasonable. So to give a couple simple examples of how that would play out, let's say you a person took a photo of their partner breastfeeding a child, which caused the exposure of a nipple. And they uploaded that onto the internet, not because they were interested in humiliating or harassing the person, but because they thought that that image was something that they wanted to share. Without the intent to injure, that's not covered under this section. Similarly, let's say that an ex-boyfriend uploads a topless photo of a former romantic partner, but that romantic partner takes a relaxed approach to nudity and doesn't much care that there's a photo of them topless on the internet. The intent to injure or harass was there, but the injury or harassment didn't actually occur, regardless of the intent. That also would be exempted. So what this is really...
Aaron, let's get a clarification. Is it based on the perception of the individual that's actually portrayed, or is it a reasonable person standard that they would be looking at?
Chair Przanski, that's a very good question. The answer is both. Under the Robertson test, which is the primary test in this area, you must intend the injury. The injury must occur, which means it must be experienced by that victim as actual, and it must be reasonable. So all three of those must be present. It's a very rigorous standard, and if you violate any of those, it's the facial challenge to the statute is almost inevitable.
I just want to make sure we have that on the record. Thank you.
So... And to be totally transparent, the sacrifices that you make in crafting these legislative concepts to get to sure-footed constitutionality can be significant. And to give an example that I think needs to be on the record, what this will absolutely capture are circumstances where a person is intentionally humiliating or harassing another person and that harassment occurs. But disinterest in whether, say, you're humiliating or harassing somebody could be problematic under this section. Two people meet at a party, they become romantically engaged, photos are taken, it seems fun at the time, and the person who takes the photos then subsequently says, well, I didn't upload them because I care about that person's feelings, I uploaded them to show my friends. It's very hard to constitutionally address that problem, and that's, and I just want to be transparent about what the Constitution requires. I think when we find ourselves in these situations where we have to really explore the nuance of free speech versus legislation, it's very important to be specific. The latter half of the bill concerns itself with exceptions.
Yes.
Before you
leave this section, I have kind of a follow-up. In some cases, if something is uploaded and the uploader has bad intent that meets the standards of the bill, the person who's uploaded, the person who's victimized, it just rolls her eyes or his eyes and doesn't really care until a year later when an employer says, I'm not hiring you because of this, and at which point they care a lot. How would that scenario be treated under this standard of proof?
Chair Przanski, Senator Burdick, my interpretation of that fact pattern, as you know, every crime has a statute of limitations attached, and I think that the commission of the act and then being followed by the realization of the harm within that time period, I don't think there'd be any question that you could at least take a swing at that charge. And I think you make a very good point, which is the damage, both psychological and reputational, of something like this can be deferred. It can also be the case, and I think frequently is the case, that these images are uploaded sometime prior to the victim ever becoming aware of their being uploaded. Unless the person who does the uploading sends you an email to let you know that there are now pictures of you on the internet, there'll need to be some other triggering event. And that triggering event will almost inevitably be that somebody, maybe you, maybe someone else, did a search for you for who knows what reason and came up with the images, and that's how you were alerted. Now, Before I get into the exception, there are two profiles I wanted to highlight here of how this plays out. The first one I've already discussed, which is when you have an individual putting these out on websites that are dedicated to that purpose. We also see them, and I think Facebook is going to testify to this, popping up on social media sites, which forces organizations like Facebook and others to just play whack-a-mole trying to take this stuff down. And I think they'll tell you how much of a problem that is for them operationally. The last area I wanted to highlight before talking about exceptions is this notion of consent. These images come up frequently in dynamics that I think we would associate with domestic violence. The images, while maybe initially taken consensually, towards the end of the relationship can be used for coercion. They can be used to keep someone in an abusive relationship. They can be used to punish someone for leaving. And similarly, consent, it's a big word with a lot of iterations. And I think Senate Bill 188 does a good job of capturing the fact that these pictures can be taken as a result of intoxication. They can be taken as a result of focus and sustained peer pressure. They can be taken a lot of ways that we might consider consensual, but which in the end have some of the characteristics or can be used for coercive purposes. The last aspect I wanted to highlight, and this is the final section of the bill, are all of the exceptions. And this is where a lot of the work happened. ACLU, ODA, OCDLA, DOJ all had to sit back and say, okay, what's every legitimate purpose we can come up with for these images? The good news is we're state number 16 to go down this path, so we have a pretty good record from other states. But this section doesn't apply to basically legitimate purposes that you'll expect. I won't read them all into the record because it's in front of you, but things like if you need to make a referral to law enforcement, turning the images over to law enforcement doesn't violate this section. If it's needed for legitimate medical purpose, it doesn't violate this section. If it's a legal proceeding, you could see how these images might become involved, say, with a divorce and need to be reviewed by lawyers. Those sorts of things don't violate this section. I want to close by thanking everybody who worked with us during session for this. This was a complex legal problem, but I do think we cracked it. And I'm open for any questions.
Thank you, Aaron. Senator Cruz.
Following up on Senator Burdick, what would be the statute on something like this? Would it be the, I mean, is it the standard or statute of limitations?
Well, this
obviously it would trigger when the offended person found out, I'm assuming. So,
Senator Przanski, Chair Przanski, Senator Cruz, I don't want to get too into the weeds on that out of fear of overspeaking, because I would need to go back and assure myself that the onset of the statute of limitations here would more likely be triggered, say, by the action or the realization of harm, because that can be an area where the law varies. So my preference would be to follow up with you separately with an exact answer.
I mean, because this, you're right, the finding out can be well after the fact, and I mean, in some cases, well after the fact. And
Going to actually be two sets of standards. The first time is going to be as a Class A misdemeanor. Second time to be as a felony. So the years are going to differ, and it doesn't sound like it's being captured into the sexual offense statute of limitations.
Chair Przanski, that is not the intent of the bill as written.
Okay.
Other questions or comments?
Aaron,
thank you very much. All right, so I have five other people at this point who want to give testimony. I'm just going to just go down the list. Michelle Roland Schwartz, Kristen Haydell, and Kelsey Wilson will be our next speakers. Ladies, whoever wants to start off, I just need to please ask for your name for the record and your testimony.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Roland Schwartz. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force. We are a statewide nonprofit whose mission is to facilitate and support a victim-centered approach to the prevention of and response to adult and adolescent sexual violence, using a multidisciplinary approach. The task force is comprised of over 100 appointed Oregonians who represent their respective fields, and that includes victim advocates, members of law enforcement in the criminal justice system, offender management professionals, sexual violence prevention specialists and educators, medical professionals, policymakers, youth, and survivors of sexual violence. I'm happy to be here today to offer the task force support of Senate Bill 188, the unlawful dissemination of an intimate image. This issue has been an important issue for the task force as we've engaged our members and partners for well over a year to discuss the nuances and complexity of this issue. We partnered with a graduate research assistant with Oregon State University Policy Analysis Lab to conduct research to help inform our efforts as we impacted this sort of policy in Oregon. And additionally, stakeholders across Oregon have shared the countless ways in which victims have been impacted and the mounting frustration that they've experienced trying to hold offenders accountable. The disclosure of intimate images without consent causes devastating harm as victims experience threats of sexual assault, stalking, harassment, shaming, and in some cases loss of job or difficulty in obtaining employment, and in some cases in a need to transfer to a different school, not to mention the ongoing humiliation as images are exposed to innumerable viewers on social media and website platforms. The emotional impact of victims vary from anxiety, depression, hypervigilance, and isolation. The experiences that we've tracked nationally and in Oregon highlight that this destructive conduct is mostly perpetrated against women and is often within the context of an abusive or coercive relationship. Victims often disengage and restrict their technological and online usage, and this only serves to further isolate and burden them with feelings of guilt and shame, while offenders are left without fearing any consequences for their actions. Senate Bill 188 would add Oregon to the 26 other states that have either passed or have introduced or pending legislation to address this issue. And the task force is happy to be here to offer our support as we look at addressing the unlawful dissemination of an intimate image in Oregon. And thank you all for the opportunity to provide testimony and support. I'm happy to answer any further questions as you need. Thank you.
Thank you. What we're going to do is take testimony from everyone, then we'll open up the panel for questions. Who would like to go next?
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, my name is Kirsten Heidel and I work as the Youth Services Coordinator and Advocate for Center for Hope and Safety. We provide services to victims and survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and human trafficking. I'm here today urging you to support the passage of Senate Bill 188, the unlawful dissemination of an intimate image. As an advocate working with victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, I constantly witness the devastation and trauma that technology is used on victims. It's a huge weapon that abusers, perpetrators, offenders use against victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. And what's more startling and upsetting is that youth primarily are this is one of their major platforms of interacting with friends and other people. When somebody uploads an intimate image of another person onto a website, oftentimes their intent is not to be kind towards that person or anything. It's to humiliate, to harass, to make that person feel degraded. And an example of this, a girl that I was working with a few years ago, she had just turned 18. She was a senior in high school, and her partner, her boyfriend, was 18 also, and when she started dating him, she thought that he was the most wonderful person in the world. He was charming. He complimented her. He said some of the most wonderful things, made her feel safe, made her feel comfortable, and this was the first time that she had ever found a relationship like this. A few years before that, she had been sexually assaulted by a classmate, and she did not report the assault because people did not believe her. And so this relationship was something that she thought was amazing. And a few months into the relationship, her partner had asked for her to send an intimate image of herself. And she felt very uncomfortable and told him that she didn't feel comfortable. And he profusely he apologized and said he felt so bad. And also, with that charm that he had used in the beginning of the relationship, he knew that she had been sexually assaulted before. And he promised he would never hurt her, do anything at all to cause harm to her. And Eventually, after a little while, he had asked again, and he was very convincing, said, you know, I love you so much. I care about you, and I miss you when we're away from each other. I wouldn't ever do anything to hurt you. This image, it's not going to go to anybody. It's just for me. It's just between us. So she sent him an image, and shortly after that, he sexually assaulted her. And because she had been sexually assaulted before, she did not report the sexual assault because people did not believe her before, unfortunately. And right after the sexual assault, he had uploaded that image onto Facebook and sent a private message out to a large group of his friends, and also uploaded the image onto a revenge porn website. She didn't go to school for a few days, but when she did, there were lots of other boys at the school that started coming up to her and harassing her, saying extremely sexually degrading and awful things to her. And other people also started sending her messages that they were going to sexually assault her and do other awful, unspeakable things. She eventually dropped out of school. She couldn't handle the bullying. She couldn't handle all of the horrific trauma from this experience. And when I sat down and met with her, all she could say, and she was sobbing, and all she could say was, I never asked for this. I never wanted this. I thought that he was somebody that I could trust. I thought that he was somebody that really cared about me. And this is just one story, just one example. There are so many more of this happening to youth that I work with. Usually it's sent out to other friends, but oftentimes it does make it to websites. And because technology is so common and prevalent, this is a really huge tool that abusers use against other people. You can imagine if you're applying for a job, or somebody Googles your name, to have that pop up and have other people see that is horrifying. And there are stories, so many stories like this across the United States we hear all the time. And sometimes it's people not even intentionally sending or consenting to sending an image to someone. Sometimes computers are hacked. And no matter how hard you try taking down an image, another one pops up on a website. And so it's endless. As an advocate, it's really difficult for me to hear sometimes when people try to excuse away the behaviors of some of these perpetrators, you know, just that they made a really bad decision or something. But you think about the damage that it causes to victims and survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault. It's horrific. They didn't intend for this to happen. They didn't ask for it to happen. We need people to hold perpetrators accountable for their behaviors, and this is just one way to do that. It's a step in the right direction. Thank you for allowing me the time to speak, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Kelsey.
Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm losing my voice, so I'm going to keep it short and sweet. For the record, my name is Kelsey Wilson, and I'm here on behalf of Facebook. I'd like to start by thanking the Attorney General Rosenblum for her work on this measure to go after individual perpetrators of revenge porn. Facebook works hard to ensure pornographic images do not appear on it, and we go to great lengths to ensure the safety of our platform. We don't want bad actors to victimize others with whom they have falsely gained trust by posting intimate images of someone without the person's consent. Facebook strongly supports Senate Bill 188 with the inclusion of the -1 amendments, clarifying that an interactive computer service is not liable for the content provided by an individual user. There are currently 16 states with revenge porn statutes, and 12 have included such language as outlined in the -1 amendment. In California, a similar new law, effective in October of 2013, is already resulting in convictions, and we're seeing this in other states as well. This bill can and will make a difference, and I urge your support of Senate Bill 188 with the amendments. Thank you for your consideration, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Burdick.
In the other states that have the -1 amendment, is there some kind of provision that if the social media company is negligent in not removing them or doesn't fulfill its responsibility to deal with the situation, that they don't get that protection?
Chair Przanski, Senator Burdick, I would go have to go back and look at that. I think the Dash 1 amendment ties to the Section 230 language that Aaron referenced earlier to take the liability off of the computer service. But I could go back and check and see if there are circumstances where if negligence that they would be liable.
Yes, I'd want to see that. I'm sure it's a pain to have to deal with this, but it's very important to have respond. I'm sure Facebook would do it anyway, but there are a lot of companies out there that you wouldn't want to just let them off the hook, and so they stopped being responsible.
Sure.
What I'm getting at.
Yeah. I'm happy to follow
up.
Yeah,
my part, I agree with Senator Burdick, that due diligence has got to be kind of somewhat in there, and or at least second bite of the apple doesn't happen. So we'll look at that. We're not moving the bill today. We're taking testimony, but we will look at that. And Kelsey, if you could find out what your legal department has, that'd be great. And then we'll circle back with Aaron Knott as well.
Thank you.
All right. I don't think there's any other questions. Ladies, thank you very, very much for coming forward today. We have two other individuals that are wanting to give testimony, April Custers and Christina Gordon. If you two would come forward. While they're coming forward, was there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 188? All right, you two will be our last speakers today. Thank you very much for being here.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, thank you so much for having me today. My name is Christina Gordon, and I'm a victim of the theft of an intimate image that was shared without my consent. I support Senate Bill 188. My story does not fit necessarily in the criteria of this bill, so it would not apply to me, but I thought that my story would be a very important one to start the conversation of how this, how stealing or obtaining an intimate image of someone and the dissemination or sharing of this photo can have a really big impact on people's lives. So my story, and don't worry, I'm not reading from the paper, but my story started in August of 2013. I had walked into my place of employment and found out that a supervisor had been fired. Shortly into my shift, I was asked to go into the office by the regional manager, where he started to tell me why the supervisor had been fired. Apparently, the supervisor, who often fixed people's laptops and cell phones, had a computer file with about 100 photos, intimate photos, of female employees past and present. On this file. This was shared onto another person's laptop and informally shared, you know, through people's cell phones. Now, I was up into the office because I was informed that somehow one of my photos had been there. I've never sent a photo. I've never, as far as I knew, I didn't even have a graphic or intimate photo on my cell phone. But nonetheless, it was there. It was stolen and hacked off of my iPhone. And I have no idea where it is now. I would say that I am fortunate enough to have not had my photo shared on one of those revenge porn websites with my personal information shared. I'm very fortunate, but it does not make me any less of a victim. I handled that news as well as I could have, left the office and broke down. I had to excuse myself from the rest of the shift. And within the same day, nearly everybody in my place of business had heard, and it had spread, and I was humiliated. I attempted to start an investigation with the Salem Police Department And it went as far as to say, I'm sorry, we can't do anything for you. It's not illegal for someone to steal your photo and share it. It doesn't have any monetary value in the eyes of the law, even though I feel that that photo of me costs a lot. It costs me a lot of things in my life. You know, it's been the epicenter of many panic attacks, depression, humiliation. It's affected me in almost every area of my life. And I sit here in front of you with this testimony, hoping that it's the first step in bringing justice to a lot of people, mostly women who fall victim to this. And speaking for them, they might be too afraid to come up here. And I'm terrified. Absolutely.
You're doing great.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Przanski. I want to stand up here and let them know that they're not alone, that someone, many people, are fighting for them. And we want to hold people accountable because as far as I know, the supervisor who had done this to me doesn't think that he did anything wrong. And there was nothing that I could do. There was no justice at all. So my justice here, hopefully, is for you to provide swift passage of Senate Bill 188, move it to the floor, let it be voted on. We need to provide the resources, the protection, and the privacy of women and people in Oregon. We are one of, you know, just many few states that are taking this on. I think that Aaron Knott has worked very hard on making this not a very narrow law. We've worked very hard on making it to where it's only applicable in the most narrowest sense. We don't want any loopholes. We don't want anyone that can fall into this and get in trouble where it does not apply. Henceforth, again, why I want to mention my photo, my instance, doesn't fit within the bill, but I'm a very strong proponent for it because it is the very first step into getting justice, and it's the very first step into finally getting justice for me, because if I can see women protected with resources and justice themselves, all of this work will be totally worth it. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
We're going to hear from the other person, April, first, then we'll open up for questions. But I want to thank you right now for stepping forward and being willing to share your story, and we'll have a little more conversation in a minute.
Thank you, Chair.
April.
Chair Przanski.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is April Custers, and I'm the Assistant Director of Student Legal Services at Portland State University. My office provides representation and advice to PSU students in their various legal troubles. A large portion of my job is domestic relations, specifically around domestic violence, and I see a lot of revenge porn cases every single academic year. So I am here to support Senate Bill 188 and specifically talk about my two current cases. I'm not going to use my clients' real names out of respect for their wishes. Both of my clients are absolutely humiliated by what's happened to them, and it's an ongoing battle for them. So I'll start with Emma. Emma is a PSU student who hopes to become a teacher. She married very young. She was only 19 years old, and her husband was 27 when they got married. During their marriage, they had a video. They took a video of one night of having sex. They thought it would be fun. Soon, though, in the relationship, signs of domestic violence showed up. There was physical abuse. There was financial control. The husband was in charge of all the finances, and the day that she finally decided to leave and get a restraining order, he cleared out the bank account, and she was left houseless, moneyless, and with those images in his possession. The very next day, he uploaded images from the video onto Craigslist under a lot of personal ads with her image and a little story about how they could get a hold of her. He then put the video up on his blog. So she obtained a restraining order. The restraining order does nothing to address the images that are out there on the internet, and they are still out there. She's had to explain to her placement at an elementary school that these are out there in case teachers, in case the teachers find it, in case the parents find it. And she has experienced a lot of humiliation. She has had to tell multiple people ahead of time that these are out there, and there's very little I can do to help her. The other client that I currently have, Kara, was very unlucky in love. She didn't date till she was a bit older. And finally, when she met Greg, he told her how beautiful she was. He encouraged her to, you know, he was very charming and charismatic. And one day he convinced her that to do a nude photo shoot, that it would help her with her self-esteem because she's so beautiful and so gorgeous. And again, there's domestic violence at play in this relationship. Once she left him, he sent those images to every single one of her friends on Facebook. She's even had to flee from the city that she lived in with him up to Portland, at which point he eventually found her, even though she had changed her name on Facebook and done extra measures to protect herself from him being able to find her. And to this day, if she has a new friend on Facebook, he will send a message and an image of her to any new contact that she makes. And again, there's very little I can do to help her out because there aren't these protections that Senate Bill 188 would provide. And so I'm happy to take any questions from the committee.
All right. Ladies, again, thank you very much for coming forward. Questions? All right. Christina, again, I want to thank you. I know from my experience of being a chair how trying it is for individuals such as yourself to have the fortitude to come forward. You're a very empowered individual that, from my perspective, had brought something to our need to understand how this actually has impacted you as a victim. And I will say that I don't know if I agree with the information you received from the Salem Police Department or whatever as to whether or not there was a crime or not committed. Based on what you told me, someone took a picture of yours that you did not consent. It's your property. And so my question is, why isn't that at least some type of a simple theft of that piece of property?
Right. So, thank you, Chair Przanski. I think that the police department did the best with what they could. I don't know if they necessarily saw the impact of it. It might not even have been to their knowledge in that department as much, which I don't blame them. They might not have been hearing as many cases. I do know that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of victims in Oregon who deal with this humiliation. Yes, I wish it would have gone somewhere else. I don't anticipate anytime soon that being reconciled. But the reason that I'm here today is so that people will have that option one day. I will not stop until they get that.
Well, we're going to try to help you out on
thank
this
you.
One.
Thank so you, thank you very Chair Przanski. Thank you, members of the Judicial Committee, so much.
All right.
Thank
I'm
you.
Going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 188.
Well, it may not be, wasn't necessarily for them to comment on, though they may choose to, but it's been pointed out that this bill is a start and that there are situations that might need to be addressed in the future. And I have another one for you in somebody taking somebody's image clothed, taking it, photoshopping it onto pornographic images along with address and information about this person where they can be contacted. That is out there as well. So, and this wouldn't address that necessarily,
yeah.
But I hope that maybe we can figure out a way to prevent things like that.
Well, one thing that we do need to, I guess, put on the record, besides criminally holding people accountable, civilly they can too. And there's multiple torts that you just mentioned that have been violated for someone to do that. So, again, I have two other committee hearings that we need to do today.
Of course.
So thank you all very much.
Thank you so much, Chair Przanski. Thank you so much, members of the Judicial Committee.
All right, so we're closing
thank you for your comment, Senator Thatcher. There's a lot of dynamics.
We're closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 188, and we're going to open up our next public hearing, which is on Senate Bill 366. Eric?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 366 comes to this committee from the Criminal Justice Commission. The bill would modify the statutory definition of recidivism for purposes of statistical analysis by state agencies and public bodies. There is no revenue impact, no fiscal impact. The bill is ready to move. No amendments.
All right, we're going to go ahead and have Mike Schmidt come forward. Mike, come on up. Is there anyone else who's here today who will want to give testimony on Senate Bill 366? Mike, you're up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. My name is Mike Schmidt. I'm the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. We bring to you today this bill, Senate Bill 366. It really comes out of our work staffing the Public Safety Task Force, the work that we've been doing implementing House Bill 3194 over this last, since it was passed in 2013. House Bill 3194 amended the definition of recidivism. It includes now two parts. One is for any new crime, we are to measure the arrest, the incarceration, and the convictions. And then there's part B, which is for any reason we are to measure the arrests, the conviction, and the incarceration. And this bill would remove that second part, the part B, the for any reason we track those things. This first came to our attention, like I said, as we were doing implementation work. It was brought to us, to the Public Safety Task Force, through Senator Winter's Subcommittee on Specialty Courts, also through Senator Przanski's Subcommittee on Measuring Outcomes, as really kind of an unworkable definition for a lot of the practitioners. For example, in a drug court setting or a probation setting, with the for any reason tracking, anytime a probation officer arrested somebody or a drug court judge took somebody into custody for missing a PO meeting or missing a treatment appointment, that would be a recidivist event. Essentially, anybody who is doing an intensive supervision model would find themselves having about 100% recidivism, because it's pretty much natural that you're likely to be at least arrested at some point for violating your probation for any reason. So the definition quickly became unworkable. It really was meaningless to say that a drug court had 100% recidivism. It doesn't lend much information to what we're trying to track, which is people actually recidivating, committing new crimes, and how well is the court or the probation officer or the supervision having an effect. So this is a technical fix. It's supported throughout all those, the Public Safety Task Force, the subcommittees. I was contacted today by the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and they asked me to put on the record their support. The Oregon OACCD, the Community Corrections Directors, we have their support. The Department of Corrections, we have their support. So it's a broad consensus of support for this technical fix, just so that the Criminal Justice Commission can track the information that we think will be most helpful to the practitioners.
All right, thank you. Questions for Mike? Thank you very much for working through this, and we appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
I'll ask once again, does anyone else want to testify on Senate Bill 366? Not seeing, we close the hearing. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 366.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 366 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 366 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions or objections?
Just a comment.
Or discussion.
Yeah, nice catch.
Good.
Okay.
All right. And I'll say the same thing. This is one of those situations when we're putting together the bill. They wanted, a number of people wanted to, let's say, modify the recidivism. And it's one of those things that kind of just sticks in the back of your mind going, wait a second, you know, just a simple arrest. And then when you hear some of the situations where that arrest could occur, it could be not for a new crime,
right,
but for a violation of a probation order or something other order that you're under the court, that would actually have the same ramification of someone who actually not only was arrested for a crime, but was actually convicted of that new crime.
All right.
Any other comments or thoughts? Any objection to the motion? Not seeing any.
Motion passes. Chair will carry, since I'm one of the co-chairs on the public safety.
That was my other suggestion.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We'll go ahead and open up our last public hearing that we have scheduled for today. This will be on Senate Bill 384. Eric?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 384 modifies existing law to require a court reporter in aggravated murder cases. Currently, the official record in criminal proceedings is by an electronic audio recording system. There is one amendment before the committee. There is no revenue impact. We do not yet have a fiscal impact on the amendment.
Okay, it looks like we're going to have at least two panels today. I'm going to go ahead and ask, if hopefully I'm saying this correct, Shalene Iverson, Elizabeth Powell, and Gail Meyer to come forward as proponents.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Howe, here representing the Oregon Court Reporters Association. In support of Senate Bill 384, this committee has seen this legislation before and passed it out of committee unanimously, so we hope you'll once again see the value and importance of this policy. Just to let you know, there is an information sheet submitted by the court reporters and support from the Bar Association up on OLIS. And to give some background on this bill, I'd like to introduce Shalene Iverson. She's a freelance court reporter in Oregon and president-elect of the Oregon Court Reporters Association. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. As Elizabeth said, I am Shalene Iverson, CSR, president-elect of the Oregon Court Reporters Association, and I own a court reporting firm in the city of Portland. I am here today to speak in support of Senate Bill 384. In the budget stress experienced by the Oregon courts in the early 2000s, the state began relying on digital audio recording and transcriptionists to create the record in Oregon courts. While the transcription of audio recorded records are acceptable in many cases, the Oregon Court Reporters Association and others that you will hear from this morning believe that there are certain cases where the stakes are just too high to rely on the digital audio recording. Aggravated murder cases, as everyone is well aware, carries the highest possible penalty, someone's life. These are cases that are automatically appealed if the accused is convicted of the crime. An accurate and timely record is essential in carrying out justice. The difficulty of an audio recorded record is that the testimony is lost when microphones are inadvertently not turned on properly, or during voir dire proceedings when the potential jurors are in the back of the courtroom sitting far away from the microphones. I have transcribed some of the recordings from the state court, and I'll tell you, it is a difficult task at best. An hour-long proceeding may take 3 to 4 hours or more to complete. Speakers have very similar voices, and it can be difficult to decipher who is speaking. There are notebooks being moved around on the tables, papers being shuffled, water being poured. And let me tell you, if someone coughs or sneezes, you cannot hear a thing. Transcripts become riddled with inaudible throughout. Another issue is the potentiality of the confidential attorney-client conversations being caught on the audio record. If there is terminology that is unfamiliar to the transcriptionist, wrong words may be used. We have heard of one audio recording that the term baby porpoises was used as opposed to habeas corpus. The worst cases, of course, have been when the system failed to record any audio at all, as in the Steelheaders case in Marion County in 2001. 3 days of proceedings were not recorded, and the judge had to declare a mistrial. The retrial was incredibly expensive to the parties and to the state of Oregon. Shorthand reporters are skilled and reliable. Currently in Oregon, if the court hires a reporter, they must be certified as defined in statute and law and rule. Certified shorthand court reporters provide verbatim transcription of court proceedings as the proceedings occur. Certified shorthand court reporters take the responsibility of creating an unbiased and accurate record very seriously. Through our training, is literally locked into our DNA to be as neutral and accurate as humanly possible. Certified shorthand court reporters are well-versed in legal proceedings and vocabulary and know how to put an appeal transcript together. Up-to-date technology allows court reporters to provide instant, searchable transcription to attorneys and judges on their own computers and their tablets. There are several former officials who have used previously worked in our court systems that remain here in Oregon and work in court on a regular basis when hired by the parties. They bring to the court their years of expertise working with judges and court staff and attorneys. We believe using a certified shorthand court reporter could actually save the state money. First, all attorneys and judges are able to receive their real-time feeds of the proceedings or uncertified copies of the transcript at the end of the day, which improves the efficiency of the attorneys, which results in fewer hourly fees. Additionally, this allows attorneys to focus in on the testimony rather than trying to take notes during the trial. This real-time file aids the attorneys in preparation for the next day. Second, the reporter is working on the transcript while the trial is in process. The appeal transcript is filed more promptly by a court reporter who reported the proceedings from the start. The shorthand court reporter is on site and able to get spellings at the time when the unusual words or names are used. The shorthand court reporter is expected to ask parties to speak one at a time or to slow down so that we have the most accurate record possible. In conclusion, a live shorthand reporter who is a part of the trial from the start provides the most accurate, timely, and usable transcript for all parties. Oregon's most serious cases need the skills and expertise provided by a live court reporter so that access to justice is there in the most serious of cases where someone's life hangs in the balance. I urge you to please vote yes on Senate Bill 384. Thank you.
Thank you. Gail?
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, Senate Bill 384 has our full support. And can I tell you that the entire segment of our membership that does do aggravated murder defense work, whether it be at the trial level, on appeal, or on post-conviction relief, really hopes this bill does see the light of day. There was a big, big shift in the courtroom when the reporting methodology went from having a court reporter present in the courtroom to having electronic recording. And it was done either by microphone or by video microphone. But there was the biggest shift that occurred was that you didn't have that separate person in the courtroom whose sole job it was to make sure that they were getting every word down. That court reporter who used to sit there and take their notes, and in the older days would even do it in shorthand, they could control the proceedings. I mean, if people started squabbling over each other, they would just raise their hands up. Or if they didn't understand something, they'd say, wait. Or they'd tell you, slow down. And I mean, they was as in control sometimes as the judge, if not more so. But they would make sure that that record was actually complete and accurate. And it's a scary proposition to really understand how compromised the appellate record is in most of our criminal cases, because the audio and video really cannot get everything. I would endorse what the witness prior to me said. My members have experiences trying to do appeals on a murders where there's just big gaps in the tapes. They can't really recreate the record. And sometimes the trial lawyers now are gone. And it's very difficult to accurately adjudicate what had happened in a courtroom when you have big, big gaps. So this does happen on your normal appeals, but definitely we do support the notion that in aggravated murder proceedings, it will simply be an accountability, a good governance thing to make sure the record is accurate and let the judicial system take it from there. So thank you.
All right. Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel?
Oh. Senator, I'm sorry, Chair Przanski, there's one other thing I want to mention, and actually is important. I forgot this. The courtrooms are not wired to record the jury. There are no microphones over there for the jury, and that's because you don't really want to listen to what the jury may or may not be saying amongst itself. But aggravated murder trials are the only trials where you actually transcribe the voir dire, meaning the jury selection process. So sometimes you have the jurors way in the back of the room because you have a lot of potential jury pool in the present, and then they come up into the jury box and you're posing questions to them, but it's not wired to pick up what they're saying in the back of the room, and it's not wired to pick up what they're saying in the jury box. So when you are relying on an audio recording or you're relying on a video recording, it's not wired to pick that up. And the jury selection process in an aggravated murder trial can be the most error-prone part of the proceeding, and yet the record does not accurately show what was said. So that's an additional reason why it's important in aggravated murder trials.
Thank you. Any questions? Ladies, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. I am going to start with the second two names because I can read the first names, Rachel and Jesse. And then the other two will come up and they'll identify themselves because I don't want to butcher the names on the record.
Hello, Chair Przanski and the committee. My name is Rachel Awai, and I am a certified electronic reporter opposing this bill. I'd first like to say that I love my job and I love my industry, and there isn't one hearing or one deposition that's ever the same, and I have the utmost respect for stenographers. However, I understand that industries evolve and adopt new processes and become more effective and efficient over time. I also understand that there's usually resistance to these changes from those that are entrenched within the older processes. However, I believe that it's a natural thing for an industry to advance and open itself up to emerging opportunities. An open industry that has few barriers to entry breeds innovation, efficiency, and strives to find cost-reducing advancements. While if the industry is closed to using a specific type of court reporter, then options are very limited to the state, and that specific type of court reporter will hold a monopoly on costs. And this encroaching on a portion of the market, sealing it off from anyone else that has an interest in it. Stakes are high for digital recording, and testimony can be lost from stenographers or from a digital recording that does fail or is not turned on. And with stenographers, they're also prone to having inaudibles in their transcripts. They can do real time, but accuracy is really, it's much more accurate to have an actual voice recording of what's going on instead of a stenographer's interpretation of what's going on. I've been doing this for quite a while, and I don't think that I've had one inaudible in any of my transcripts. So with that, I'm going to toss it over to Jesse.
Good morning, Chair and the committee. My name is Jesse Brown. I'm a certified court reporter. More specifically, I'm a certified electronic court reporter. I was certified through a highly respected and nationally recognized organization that orchestrates itself much similar to the NCRA, who is the corporation that certifies stenographers. I've had a very successful career here in the Northwest. I judge my success solely on the companies and entities that I work for and their return rate. I've handled pretty much every type of deposition from arbitration to mediation, closed case hearings, contested hearings, anything that you can imagine. In no way do I take credit for my success. It is the tools that I use. Electronic court reporting, if used correctly, is very efficient. It's cost-effective, it's revolutionary, and it's accurate. Digital court reporting allows a broader range of more complex situations, larger groups to be heard. We're able to record more speakers without having misidentified tags on them. We're seeing a new type of accuracy. When asked for a readback, you're not going to get me calmly quoting a very angry or frustrated attorney. You're going to get the recording, pardon me, you're going to get the question played back exactly the way it was asked by the person that it was asked. As we all know, tone has a lot of power. Your audio file can be synchronized to your transcript. As you're reading your transcript, you will hear the actual word being said. This is making every word verifiable and taking out any type of interpretation, I would add. This is the difference between getting a transcript with my personal interpretation of what I thought was said and what was actually said at the time of the hearing. Again, this is the record that we're creating. There have been attempts at passing this identical bill or very similar bills for the past 10 years. So what's changed in the last 10 years? Technology. Definitely technology has changed. Your iPhones alone, I mean, you're capable of doing a lot. With the growth of this profession, it's created a lot of opportunity for innovation. For my software, I have 24-hour support. I work hand-in-hand with the developers, where they're able to customize controls and buttons into my software that specifically meets my needs. Microphones, the recording equipment that is available today is incredible. The technology is impressive. This is the digital age. This method of court reporting will do nothing but progress and continue to grow. I appreciate all of your time.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Thatcher.
It was mentioned to me that it takes a while to transcribe recordings, like voice recordings. So how would you turn around and get a, you know, a transcript in, you know, a case that's
very good question. Very often, attorneys are requesting a rough draft, or they have trial coming up that they need an expedited transcript. I'm able to transfer the audio as it's being recorded. That way there is no lag. Not only that, I'm able to do it with multiple types of backups, so you're getting different tones. If there's a lot of people talking in the room, we're able to isolate the different frequency which it is coming in. A lot of the companies I work for will fly me across the nation every month because that they know that they can consistently get accuracy from us. We're talking about organizations such as National Bar Associations or Medical Society, things where that they're going to read every word in that transcript, and it's important to make sure that every word is correctly what was said at the time.
Any other questions? Question for both of you. How many aggravated murder cases have either of you actually been the recording officer or reporter for?
I have not been the court reporter for an aggravated murder case, but I have been for wrongful death cases.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yourself?
I have not.
Okay, thank you.
I don't believe I'm allowed to as of right now.
All right. Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I apologize for the other two who are scheduled to give testimony. I did not want to try to say your names because, be very frank, I just cannot read the names. So this would be self-identifying.
No, I apologize for my poor penmanship. My name is Marcia Nagley, and I own Nagley Deposition and Trial, and I have owned it for a little over 35 years. This bill has been attempted to be passed now for, I believe, 12 to 15 years, and I feel bad that it has to keep coming up. But what I really believe it is, or am positive it is more of a Trojan horse. It's really preservation of a method that's becoming obsolete. The National Stenography Association, it allows only stenographers. It was formed, I believe, in the 40s, and so the name is the National Court Reporters Association, has lost 31% of its membership since 2001. They're losing 500 to 1,000 members a year. The schools have closed in a exponential amount of closures, and there is article after article in panic about what they're going to do because there are no more stenographers coming into the field. The certified stenographers, they're all stenographers, got certified 25 years ago. There was 240 that were at its inception in 1990. It is down by more than 100. There's 131 left. 52 were grandfathered in, who at this point would be anywhere from 50 to 80 years old. The test is no longer given by the state of Oregon at all. And the last few times it was given, I've got the documentation. Bear with me for a quick second. There was, I had it somewhere. There was, I think we have the last six tests documented from the Judicial Department.
And there was, I believe, one, it's twice a year, one passed. Thank you. The first time the test was given, this is the last seven times, one passed. The next time it was given 6 months later, two passed. 6 months later, zero passed. Zero passed. Two passed. One passed. And one passed. The test is so difficult, nobody passes. It was originated by the stenographers. So this is more of a preservation than an issue regarding the actual accuracy. The stenographers are promoting the bill. What's happening now is AAERT, the American Association of Electronic Reporters and Transcribers, is growing by 5% a year. The National Stenographer Association is dissipating by 500 to 1,000 a year. AAERT, the majority of, there's many, many states where the majority of reporters now are the electronic or digital reporters. And I gave you, folks, a packet so you could see all the facts. The president wrote a letter. And here is an article from the, there was an article written by the California newspaper, and it says it's common knowledge that stenographer versus electronic reporting has been going on for a very long time. It's not about quality. It's about preservation of a specific method, which is being replaced by a technology that's more cost-effective and accurate. There are many stories where stenographers have actually had to be put in jail because they would not or could not do their transcripts, or mistrials because stenographers could not accurately transcribe their notes. I've included in your packet a article where there was a mistrial on a Florida murder case. A Florida man convicted of murder and sentenced to life in prison will now get a new trial, all thanks to a court stenographer who erased the entire transcript of the murder trial. The county is currently pushing against the wishes of stenographers to replace the old human paper and disk model with digital recorders instead. It actually should come down to the fact that if money's going to be spent, let's spend it on improving the electronic recording. The United States Supreme Court has gone from stenographer to electronic recording. The Senate has gone from stenographer to electronic recording. The House, the state of California courts just voted a couple years ago to eliminate the court reporters, and they've let many, many of them go. It's a process where they're replacing them as they go. The House and Senate, you're recording all of the hearings and laws that are governing the murderers and the child abusers. Are you having problems with your transcripts? There's shuffling of papers, everything here. Let's improve the courtrooms. Remember years ago we had the old VHS tapes with recording? Now they're on little flash drives. We can record up to almost 100 yards away. Let's put in the proper wiring. And I agree, there were problems and there have been problems with electronic recording. But with it being in stereo now, the redundancy, all we've got to do is improve the courthouses and not have to have a replacement. We can also hire someone to monitor the recording so it does get turned on if that's been a problem. There was a case cited by the former panel from 2001 where there was a problem. 2001. This is 2015. So it's just prudent to invest in the technology and allow all methods in. One of my last comments is the Voice Writer Association, they're also certified or allowed to be certified from last session. They speak into a mask. There's only 800 in the United States. There's not one living in Oregon, not one. So, you know, let's let all of the technologies come in and embrace them all for the accuracy of the transcript. It's all about the accuracy of the transcript. And I thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the Judicial Committee. My name is Yvette Winden. I'm the corporate manager for Negley Deposition and Trial, and I have been in that position for 15 years. I have two issues, really, with this bill. One being is that it specifically states that a shorthand reporter is a stenographer or a voice writer. And the testimony that you've heard today is about the coming of newer technologies, which is the electronic reporting or digital reporting. It's the wave of the future. It's where everyone is going. It's Supreme Court. It's courthouses. It's going to be here, and it's in use now. This bill doesn't address that. It says that you can be a certified court reporter, and that is a stenographer or a voice writer. There aren't any voice writers in Oregon. So that just leaves the stenographers. And again, there are 131 certified stenographers right now available to the courts. 52 of those were grandfathered in. And again, that makes them 50 to 75, 80 years old now. With the newer technologies, why would we limit ourselves to a small group? It limits the availability. It limits the newer technologies. Digital reporting, if we make the investment and do the things that we should be doing to advance court reporting, should include all forms of court reporting, not just a stenographer. If we're going to invest money into a system, let's invest it where it should be. Let's put it into advancing the equipment that's in the courtrooms. Let's, you know, take the time to figure out where we can use that money the best, instead of putting it into aggravated murder trials where we're requiring a stenographer only. My other issue with this bill is that there's a section in it that says, yes, we want a certified stenographer or voice writer for all aggravated murder trials, except where none is available. That doesn't solve the problem. I mean, if we're going to require that you want a court reporter at all aggravated murder trials, why would you put a section in there that says, unless one's not available? Let's make sure that there is one available. Let's make sure that the law we're going to pass is going to be allowing electronic or digital reporters who are certified. Let's make sure that we're changing the bill to something that is going to work for all court reporters and not just the stenographers. So thank you for your time. And any questions, please ask.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Ladies, thank you very much for coming forward. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 384? Not seeing anyone come forward, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 384. And Eric, I think that covers everything for today. So we're going to go ahead and adjourn for today. Thank you, everyone, for being here today, and we'll see the committee back at 8:30 tomorrow. Committee back at 8:30 tomorrow.